Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Happy Juneteenth. Today is June 19th, a day that's been a federal holiday for 5 years now, and for good reason. It was on June 19th, 1865, that enslaved Americans in Galveston, Texas, deep in what had been the Confederacy, were finally made aware of the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, which had technically ended slavery in the U.S. Today, Juneteenth marks the actual independence of black people in this country, more so than July 4th, 1776, whose 250th anniversary we're celebrating next month. So how do we reconcile those two observances in 2026? We're going to spend today's program discussing the meaning of Juneteenth's past, present, and future, especially in light of current efforts in Florida and across the country to whitewash, if not erase, the parts of American history that Juneteenth represents, not just for black Americans, but Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, the whole e pluribus unum tapestry that makes America, America. I spoke recently with two important South Florida voices on this matter, Dr. Tamika Bradley, who is regional manager of Broward County Library's African American Research Library and Cultural Center, and the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and Brian Knowles, who is CEO and co-founder of the educational consulting firm Teach, Heal, Build. Tamika Bradley, can you briefly remind us the origins of Juneteenth, June 19th, 1865. How did this come about?
Well, the reality of Juneteenth starts and is grounded in the reality of enslavement of black people here in the United States. The first group on record that we know of that were brought to the British North American colonies dates back to 1619.
Right.
And so you have centuries of enslavement here. And as the country develops, goes through its own revolutions, there are all of these tensions around whether or not slavery should exist. And that eventually gets this nation to the U.S. Civil War. Mm-hmm. And part of the fear is that the Republican Party at the time, even though they were only speaking about containing slavery and limiting it to where it existed, that got interpreted as their desire to end slavery, right, which was, of course, false. But within that, and this is something that I love, is that African Americans were listening carefully on those plantations to mm-hmm. things that they were not supposed to be privy to, but they understood that the pending war and this conflict was an opportunity for them to be free. Right. And so even though you have black folks always attempting and sometimes successfully escaping from the institution of slavery, that is going to increase with the outbreak of the war.
And one of the reasons so many enslaved black people enlisted to fight with the Union army.
That doesn't happen immediately.
No, not immediately.
Yeah. It's because there's always in this country been tension around military service for black men,
mm-hmm.
Because caught up in that is citizenship and voting. And so there has been a lot of resistance, whether they're talking about the American Revolution, War 1812, mm-hmm. and even the Civil War of black men having it. But as the war goes on, it starts in 1861, Lincoln and others are expecting it to be really quick and dirty. Everybody thinks they're going to, just eliminate the other. But by the time we get to 1862 and there are tremendous losses, it's going to be emancipation that Abraham Lincoln proposes as a way to bring the South to the table.
Yeah.
And so it's there are several tracks that you can talk about that it comes up not as an intention at the outset of the war, but Lincoln sees it as a way to end hostilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beginning of the promise of emancipation when it actually goes into effect on January 1st, 1863. We do have a small number of enslaved black people who are in areas where the Union is in control. And that's mm-hmm. an important point because there are limitations in that document. It can only be enforced where the Union government has it. And so
right.
that's really the beginning of these mm-hmm. emancipation celebrations and observances. It's not until the war is over in April of 1865 that you can have this realization of the promise of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
And that news begins to slowly flow. through the South, through Georgia. Union troops arrive in Tallahassee on May the 20th, 1865, mm-hmm. and read the Emancipation Proclamation, symbolically ending slavery here in the state of Florida.
Florida, right.
And that's been Florida's anniversary for years. And again, traveling to enforce, those same Union troops make their way to Galveston, Texas. They make the announcement there on June the 19th of 1865. Mm-hmm. So I know it's a complicated
you raise a great point that I think a lot of people don't realize is that there were perhaps several Juneteenths at this time where, you know, at different times and at different places, enslaved blacks were suddenly apprised of the fact of the Emancipation Proclamation. Why then, Brian Knowles, did June 19th, 1865, then become the sort of umbrella date for that Juneteenth observance that we're talking about today?
Typically speaking, you know, when we propagate narratives around history, we oversimplify them, right?
Sure.
And I want to kind of also bounce off of some of the same sentiments that we're learning under a premise that June 19th becomes that day because Union troops finally get to Texas, which was one of those more frontier strongholds of enslavement. But again, you know, when you think about the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, that was issued in 1863, it did not eliminate slavery, right? It was just places where it was Confederate states and places that fell under Union control.
It took the end of the Civil War, as she pointed out, to make that a reality.
Because you still had slavery practice in some of those border states, you know, even after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued in 1863. So you got border states like places like Kentucky and Missouri where there was no kind of ramifications of emancipation or just ending slavery in those particular spaces.
Well, did Juneteenth then become the date to observe because it was the culmination, the last place perhaps where enslaved black people were finally apprised of the fact, as I said, that emancipation had come?
So I think we have two things that are at play here, right? We have the historical reality of how emancipation played out real time. Mm-hmm. And then we have, as Brian is pointing to, right, the way it has taken on a meaning of its own. And what we say about Juneteenth, and it is technically true, it was the last location where you have a stronghold where there were enslaved
people. In Galveston, Texas.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so the symbol of reading and announcing emancipation in Galveston, in the same way that reading the Emancipation Proclamation in Tallahassee becomes the symbolic end within the state of mm-hmm. that practice.
Right? Right.
And so those anniversaries are going to be celebrated in those particular communities for 161 years now that mm-hmm. these practices still going on. But Juneteenth, for the purposes of this recent holiday announced 5 years ago, mm-hmm. has taken on, been forced to take on, right? Meaning of all this. And I share Brian's frustration that he speaks to. It is so problematic. It's beautiful. Yeah. I think on the one hand, when you get to the shorthand of history and these really occasional inflections on the calendar where we all can come together and have a public discussion about history and its meaning. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for Juneteenth for that reason, because it is a necessary counterbalance to the 4th of July.
Yes.
Because the 4th of July doesn't have the same meaning mm-hmm. for us as black Americans.
And I want to get to that. But I also want to explore then the point that you both make about May 20th. How then is Juneteenth or May 20th, then how does that play out as an observance here specifically in Florida?
I will say that I grew up celebrating what we called May Day. An occasion where the community got together. It was multi-generational. It was lots of fun. There was lots of food. It took place at what was then my middle school, but had been the historic black high school in the years prior to segregation. Mm-hmm. And so these celebrations still go on even today. There is an unbroken history of over 160 years of celebration of May Day in mm-hmm. the state of Florida. It is our Emancipation
and
Day.
And this May Day being, again, May 20th.
Correct.
Okay, and how did that play out as you were growing up?
And the same thing, you know, it was something that was not as major. And I think that's why we see Juneteenth kind of taking off a little bit more, right? Because holidays are usually going to be kind of around some ways of marketing and capitalism, right?
Yeah.
And Juneteenth was one of those things that you had a Juneteenth flag that existed and so forth, right? And it was something that was widely practiced already in Texas, mm-hmm. in opposed to here in Florida, where you probably had a few families, right?
No, we're going back that up a little bit.
Okay.
This is really regional, because if you mm-hmm. think back to Florida in 1865, where we are now was wilderness, right? And
yes.
or populated by the remaining Seminole Indians who
indigenous
were here,
people.
Right?
Yep.
In North Florida, this is the rage. There are speeches, there are parades every year. This is a huge part of
gotcha.
The
How
tradition.
Much of that is a factor of the fact that the proclamation was read in Florida in Tallahassee and, say, not in Miami?
There really wasn't a Miami to speak of.
Yeah.
And so that accounts for the regionalization of the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But I've really been working for these last 5 years with a group, Florida African American Heritage Preservation Network, who've been greatly concerned about the accuracy. That's very
yes.
frustrating to have this history now be overshadowed. And you think about what it takes to organize community celebrations and keep a tradition for 150 years or more. So to have a new federal holiday come along and mm-hmm. collapse and erase, and then have all of your Floridians bandwagon and get on board with a holiday that has its roots in Texas is a bit frustrating mm-hmm. as a Florida historian.
Well, let me just ask one real quick question here. Do other black communities in states, say like, you know, Georgia or Louisiana, do
Absolutely.
They feel the same way, because they feel that Juneteenth mold is being, you know, sort of imposed on them when their states actually had their own
yes.
May 20th. Yeah.
I don't know about you, Brian, but I have seen more observances of non-Juneteenth Emancipation Days than I ever have in the last 5 years, particularly last year.
You agree?
I would say in the last couple of years we've seen that. But even mm-hmm. going back to the original question, you know, when I was a kid and so forth, you know, Juneteenth was something that we heard about. And we did hear about Emancipation Day here in Florida, but it was something that was not a widely known narrative, a shared narrative about even our local history. Even today, as a native Floridian, that growing up, when we talk about black history and we think about the larger narrative of American history, I knew very little about Florida's history, my local history, mm-hmm. During that time period, because there were more dominant or prevailing narratives mm-hmm. that took root over that, which is the same thing that happened with Juneteenth in some cases.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Brian Knowles of Teach, Heal, Build, and historian Dr. Tamika Bradley of the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward County about the observance of Juneteenth, its history, and its contemporary importance for communities like ours. Jumping off on what we've just been talking about then, Dr. Bradley, I want to ask you how the black community then, both in Florida and around the country, reconciles the two independence observances of this country. You've got one on the 4th of July, 1776, and another, June 19th, 1865. How does the black community reconcile that in light of the fact that on July 4th, 1776, a large chunk of the population of this country was not free and really cannot look at that day as a day of independence?
The first thing that comes to my mind is a concept that was given to us by Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us the idea of double consciousness. It was published mm-hmm. in his book, The Souls of Black Folk, in 1903.
The founder of the NAACP.
One of the founders, right. Yes. And he used this term, double consciousness, to really vivify what it's like to be a black American, that you experience everything that the country has to offer, all the promises, all the storybook narrative of who we are and how we are, but then you have a separate lived reality as a person of color and the things that you have to deal with. Of course, this is a man who's living in Jim Crow America, and there are many, many narratives and experiences that fly in the face of this dominant narrative. So I think when in the Black American community, what you will find is that we know how to hold two truths. First and foremost is a day off from work and a holiday.
That part.
Right. Okay. So we will always.
An opportunity to get together with family and celebrate.
Mm-hmm. Sure. add Thanksgiving in with a mix of that, you know, with all the complications that come with the observance of that history. So we know how to take advantage of the day to celebrate community. Juneteenth, however, However, the energy and the joy that has come with the pronouncement of a federal Juneteenth Independence Day has been something glorious to witness. I think for a group of people who have struggled to be seen and be included in the larger narrative, to finally have a day that recognizes two things, right? Juneteenth is easy, I think, for the majority of Americans because we like the great story. We like the happy story. And Juneteenth, in recognizing liberation, is the happy story, something we all mm-hmm. can get behind. Yep. But the other reality is that in order to be freed, you have to have been enslaved. And so on the other side of Juneteenth is the acknowledgement that slavery was real here in the United States.
Dr. Bradley said it perfectly, mm-hmm. right? That was a excellent articulation of that. And understanding, first of all, that we played an active part in the emancipation of this country itself and as Americans, right? Mm-hmm. And also celebrating that part, our contributions of creating this nation, despite mm-hmm. our condition and despite our status in this nation, but yeah. still that we contributed to this nation. So therefore, that holiday belongs to us just as much as white Americans.
And talking about the contribution to building the nation, particularly in light of the fact that we've got sitting in the Supreme Court right now a case about birthright citizenship, how important was Juneteenth to leading to the 14th Amendment in terms of conferring citizenship, not just on enslaved black people, but anyone born here on U.S. soil, et cetera? Would Juneteenth have really meant as much without sort of culminating then in the 14th Amendment?
My perspective is I don't think that Juneteenth will have that same weight mm-hmm. if you didn't have a passage of the 14th Amendment, which gives us citizenship, and also 15th Amendment, which gives black men mm-hmm. The opportunity to vote and enfranchisement, right? So therefore, the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and so forth, actually mm-hmm. adds weight to Juneteenth because not only are we free, but we're experiencing freedom as an American, as we should in this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Dr. Bradley?
I agree. I think I do tend in my mind to separate the holiday from the lived reality of the actual history. When we look at what happened after the Civil War, the reality of emancipation as number one, an announcement, then an enforcement, then you're having to contend with what to do with 4 million people who really have mm-hmm. not had any status under this government. And then you have to go back to the mm-hmm. rule of law, right? What does the law say about their status? The law is, at that point in time, points back to the 1857 decision of Dred Scott versus Sanford,
yes. mm-hmm.
which our one of the justices in writing that opinion said that black people had no rights that white people were bound to respect,
yes.
because we were okay. not citizens of these United States. Mm-hmm. And so it took the corrective of the 14th Amendment not only to address the issue of black Americans, but in all of the for all the good things and not so good things that our founding fathers, so-called founding fathers, did, they failed to define what citizenship in these United States meant. And okay. so it was a fix that was necessary. It was a fix that certainly was inspired by trying to figure out what to do with four million people who were now coming into the body politic. Mm-hmm. And it's, when we talk about the evolution of this more perfect union, then you get to the 15th Amendment, right? And so now that your citizens, black men, have the right
to vote.
In theory, the practice was complicated.
To say the least.
Yes.
To say the
least.
Freedom has been complicated for yeah. us.
Freedom has been complicated. I will yeah. co-sign on that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's, I go back to what Brian said so brilliantly. What's the frustration, I think, for those of us who know the history is the oversimplification. There are so sure. many things
yes.
that get overshadowed, so many complexities that get just
there's
super
simplified. So many
simplified.
Nuances in it, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I hope that people during this season of celebration mm-hmm. take the time. It's really worth exploring and expanding your understanding of this period in time and what it has meant to this mm-hmm. country and how we really had to come back and do it all again mm-hmm. in the 1950s and 60s. To get it right.
Well, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Brian Knowles and Dr. Tamika Bradley about Juneteenth. And before we take a break, a reminder you can enjoy the best of this week's WLRN feature stories and their impactful reporting on South Florida with our weekend newsletter. Sign up at wlrnnews.org/newsletters. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thank you. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. Today is June 19th, and so we're devoting today's program to a discussion of what the relatively new federal holiday called Juneteenth means in terms of America's past, present, and future. The date it commemorates, June 19, 1865, has come to represent the actual moment of freedom for enslaved black people in this country, and yet the vital parts of this country's history that Juneteenth represents are under threat of erasure today. I spoke recently with Dr. Tamika Bradley, regional manager of Broward County Library's African American Research Library and Cultural Center, and the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and Brian Knowles, who is CEO and founder of the educational consulting firm Teach, Heal, Build. Here is the second part of our conversation. As we're moving forward in history, after Juneteenth, after the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, Reconstruction, how in Florida did all of this affect the development of black communities that were emerging at that time, Liberia, Liberty City, Pearl City, et cetera?
When we talk about emancipation, I can't speak about South Florida per se. We got a few decades before we really get to the settlement there. Mm-hmm. But in
North Florida.
Sure. And let's take Tallahassee, for example. Mm-hmm. It's where the Emancipation Proclamation was read, May 20th, 1865. Almost immediately, you're going to have the formation of majority black communities. In mm-hmm. Tallahassee, it was Frenchtown. In places like St. Augustine, it was Lincolnville. Mm-hmm. In places like Jacksonville, it was La Villa. You will see these now freed black people. Some of them decide to stay on the former plantations, and sometimes they're hired as laborers. But many people want to test their freedom. Am I really free? One of the ways to prove that is to leave and to migrate. Mm-hmm. And so you will see large numbers of African Americans not only migrating into cities, but one of the other phenomena here that really speaks to the pain, the painful experience of enslavement, is that so many people are traveling to the place that they heard their ancestors were, their loved ones were sold.
Yes.
And so there is a massive movement to reunify families.
Mm-hmm.
There is a massive movement to legalize marriages. One of the painful parts of slavery is that there was no legal recognition of marriages, because slave owners did not want to be inconvenienced if they wanted to sell off mm-hmm. a husband from someone who they counted as their wife, or children away from their parents. And so you have mass marriages where dozens of couples will come together before a justice of the peace and have their marriages and unions. Sometimes they've been together for 20, 15, 30 years, but they are going to get those recognized. So it's really a beautiful period of time when you look at what black folks are doing once the yoke of slavery has been thrown off. When we get the 15th Amendment, and here in the state of Florida, it's as early as 1868 that mm-hmm. black men are able to vote and hold office. You're going to have black office holders at every level. We even have mm-hmm. a black Secretary of Education here in the state of Florida with Jonathan Gibbs. We send black men to Washington, D.C. to represent us in Congress. One of the legacies of those black elected officials who are meeting the demands of their constituents, their black constituents, is we have the establishment for the first time in the state of Florida and through other southern states of public education.
Mm-hmm.
There were no systems of public education in the South
mm-hmm.
until black legislators and black citizens demanded mm-hmm. it. And that's a kind of another story, right? In terms of lessons learned under slavery, learning to read had been banned. It was illegal if you were enslaved. And so these people were very keen and understood that the key to their freedom and the freedom of their children and grandchildren was wrapped up in their ability to learn. Many of the HBCUs that are still here in the state of Florida were founded within that 25-year span after emancipation.
But Brian Knowles, moving into the next century, the 20th century, and going back to those South Florida black communities that I was referring to, how resilient did these communities have to be in order to keep building and growing into the 20th century?
The African spirit is resilience, right? That is part of the definition of just the black narrative and the experience of black folks in this country is resilience and resistance. And I'm going to start now to go back, and I work on a lot of oral history projects with elders in our communities. And when we talk about segregated cities and towns and communities, we usually think of just downtroddenness when we think about Black communities. Mm-hmm. But there is not one elder that I've ever spoke to that have had that narrative, right? Because our communities are filled with resilience, pride, and we see even immediately after Reconstruction, especially going into the 20th century, when literally all of the freedoms that we did gain during the Reconstruction era was literally taken away from us through a series of legislation and laws, and we're literally entering into the Jim Crow era at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But despite all of these obstacles, we had a lot of success in our institutions and infrastructures that we independently built within our communities.
And so much success that, as I recall, I think it's Pearl City, for example, is an example of this. We often talk about the Black migration south to north in this country. Regarding communities like that, there was actually a migration of Black people from north to south, from places like Georgia
into
South Florida.
Yes.
Is that not an indication of how attractive and successful these Black communities in South Florida had become, that they would attract that kind of migration from the south?
And absolutely. And even another indication of that is a lot of the domestic terrorism that we had to experience within our communities as well.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the Black Wall Street or the Greenwood District of Tulsa, the Greenwood District and, you know, Rosewood, Florida, and other communities that were victims of domestic terrorism, also exemplifies an unfortunate, you know, example of that. Is one of the worst extreme examples of that shows that indicates that we had successful communities. But just the fact that we were separate, segregated, and we had our own successful communities, and we navigated through segregation, and despite that we were attacked. And you hear so many stories of just the wealth that was being generated in some of these communities, the level of excellence and the standard of excellence that we had within our educational institutions, despite, you know, not getting equal funding, despite the barriers that we experience, shows our resilience.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Brian Knowles of Teach, Heal, Build, and historian Dr. Tamika Bradley of the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward County, and the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, about the observance of Juneteenth, its history, and its contemporary importance for communities like ours. Tamika Bradley, I think what we've been talking about also now sort of brings us appropriately to the big issue today of the efforts in a lot of circles to try to eliminate Black history in the classrooms and elsewhere. How is the Black community, as far as you're concerned, pushing back on that sort of anti-DEI, you know, effort?
It's very painful. I think I still, when I read the landscape, so much of Juneteenth, even coming up this year, is very much about celebration. It's about the cookout. It's about the party. I desperately wish that there was an agenda by which we would take a moment on Juneteenth and really have a critical conversation about the status of our freedom. We are celebrating something that happened in 1865, but how are we assessing the trajectory of that freedom and our ability to enjoy it, our ability to protect it? The willingness of our allies to assist us in that measure. Because if we were going to have that conversation, I think we would be having an incredibly sober conversation this Juneteenth. We have witnessed over the last 5 years, and particularly acutely here in the state of Florida, a significant rollback in the ability of our community to pursue the expression of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about history, when we talk about intellectual freedom, while there has been, within the larger effort, these attacks are general. I think about attacks on reading with book bans within our state. I think about the attacks on intellectual freedom and the ability of faculty members to exercise their freedom and academic freedom. All of those things are really under assault in unimaginable ways, if I'm honest with you. I would have never have imagined. But within mm-hmm. that, there has been, as you've pointed to, specific attempts to really limit the stories that are told. And the language that we have, going back to HB1 in 2021 with Stop Woke, was the discomfort that these conversations allegedly caused to people who had to hear them. And all the way up to what we're dealing with right now with the signing of SB 1134, the new DEI law, that will prevent cities and counties from using taxpayer dollars to fund anything that references. It's, you know, again, when we talk about Juneteenth, when we talk about 4th of July, who's a citizen in this country? Who gets to be celebrated as a citizen? Whose history gets to be celebrated? Whose culture gets to be celebrated? Why as a taxpayer or am I being discriminated against and not having the ability to have my story told?
But not only to keep the stories from being told, but in some instances to change the story itself, as we saw, you know, in the past couple of years with the attempts to change the narrative of slavery itself, that perhaps it had, quote, benefits, you know, for enslaved people. Brian Knowles is an educator. How do we work around the new assaults on teaching not just Black history, but any history of minorities, Latinos, for example, that challenges that, let's say, Project 2025 effort to whitewash the negative content of American history?
I believe we've gotten to a point where we need to take responsibility for teaching our children ourselves. We can't leave ourselves contingent on systems and institutions that have never worked in our interest to affirm our kids. So I think that we, as within a Black community, need to capitalize off of the spaces that we do have. And like Dr. Bradley mentioned, you know, have some critical dialogue, right? We're creating spaces to have celebrations, but are we intentional about creating those spaces to have critical conversations and also educate our children and identify ways that we can adequately educate our children and teach our story in the most authentic fashion?
I want to go back to something you said just a second ago when you talked about pushing back against negative content. I just want to be sensitive around the language there. There is nothing necessarily negative about Black history. Black history
I'm not suggesting Black history. Is that what I'm saying is that you have a lot of people who look at, you know, slavery and say, well, we don't want to, because that's too negative about our history. We don't want to deal with that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, I just want to relanguish that and say that it's a reality. It happened. It was real. This country benefited from it. It's a part of my ancestry. And so we just dealing with the plain truth. There is no shame in that. And to counter some of what people say about the reasons why they don't want to talk about it, I think when you tell a complete and full history of the story, it is beautiful in its complexity. Mm-hmm. It is shown when we get it right, when we work in favor of everyone's humanity and include everybody, we can do amazing things in this country. And it pains me that this intent that we see, this march forward, this effort is really seeking to erase something that is so positive and something that we actually need in this very moment. Because my question is, why are so many of our citizens, Black folks are a minority of this population? We have limited control over what's happening, especially here in Florida legislatively. Mm-hmm. I have to think about all of the citizens here, not just us. What are their thoughts about the way that things are going? There is a microscope that can be placed on our particular experience. It is particularly painful, but this is something that all of us are experiencing.
We'll take a break right here, and when we come back, we'll look at what the future holds for Juneteenth as we continue our conversation with Brian Knowles and Dr. Tamika Bradley. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Today is June 19th, and so we're devoting today's program to a discussion of what the relatively new federal holiday called Juneteenth means in terms of America's past, present, and future. The date it commemorates, June 19th, 1865, has come to represent the actual moment of freedom for enslaved Black people in this country, and yet the vital parts of the country's history that Juneteenth represents are under threat of erasure today. I spoke recently with Dr. Tamika Bradley, Regional Manager of Broward County Library's African American Research Library and Cultural Center, and the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and Brian Knowles, who is CEO and founder of the educational consulting firm Teach, Heal, Build. Here is the final part of our conversation. Brian Knowles, we're coming up on the 250th anniversary of the United States, again, since July 4th, 1776. But when you look at recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings, like the recent one on racial districting in Louisiana, for example, that could go a long way toward reducing black representation, not only in that state, but in other states in this country. 250 years later, do you fear when you're observing Juneteenth that we are backsliding when you see rulings like that and efforts like in Tennessee, for example, to reduce black representation in congressional district maps?
I absolutely do see it as a regression. Black American story is the American story. And when we are trying to so-called sanitize or get rid of these narrative that is so-called labeled negative, it is everybody's story. And what I mean by that is that if we were victims of some of these horrible injustices of these countries, there are perpetrators of this. And those perpetrators want to sanitize their story, mm-hmm. right? And want to hide from that truth. So I want to kind of go back there and to come back forward.
Sure.
And what I mean about the regression of that and just how us not having these authentic dialogue and conversations is that we have a whole generation that may come up in a whole era that has normalized what we're experiencing right now, redistricting, pretty much gerrymandering mm-hmm. at this point in states like Louisiana, even here in Florida, mm-hmm. right? That we're going to have a whole generation that's going to almost exist in a climate of that is similar to Jim Crow right now, because we have set a dangerous precedent by taking away our stories in schools, right? Because mm-hmm. conservatives have labeled this as divisive language, but the reality of it is that we don't go back in history and look at the ugly parts of our history, the inconvenient narratives of our history, we can never rectify where we are today. And if we don't rectify where we are today, it presents the perfect opportunity to roll back all of the efforts and the progress and everything that our ancestors resisted and fought for.
I'd like to jump in there around this term of regression. I've been reading Eddie Glaude Jr.'s latest book, America USA, where he is tracing back the history of these anniversary celebrations from the 100-year, 150-year to 200-year and the pending 250th. And one of the things that I have been left with that is an incredibly haunting feeling that I think I live within my subconscious, but his book brings forward, is the remarkable consistency in this country of its resistance to including black folks on the one hand in the story of America and its celebrations, but the lack of commitment to fully integrating black folks into the domestic reality, democratic reality of this country.
Yes.
It's particularly painful for me because I think about all the lessons I learned about what it meant to be an American as a schoolgirl. And we used to be very proud of the fact that we were a diverse nation and that all of these people, regardless of their religious background, their racial backgrounds, could come here and live equally and have opportunity, could even be president. But what we are seeing now is that we don't want to hear any of that. We don't want to see you. It feels like America has had almost black folks that have a 250-year plus love affair with this country, and we keep trying to be seen and trying to be embraced and trying to be loved, and it's this unrequited love affair.
But what about some of the more positive, hopeful signs out there? For example, last year we had the pleasure of interviewing Etta Fields Black about her Pulitzer Prize-winning history about the Combi raid and Harriet Tubman. And with her, we were also talking with her mother, Dorothy Jenkins, who heads the Black Archives here in Miami. And I couldn't help coming away from that conversation feeling that, you know, despite everything we've just been talking about now, there is, you know, something positive to say about the future of Black history and how it's being, pushed forward. No?
Last year, maybe. This year, the institution that Dorothy Jenkins Fields founded in the Black Archives can now no longer receive city or county funding under the new law.
Under the new law, right.
Mm-hmm. The book, the brilliant book that Etta Fields Black has written, can no longer be a subject of conversation. If she was trying to work here in a Florida university, she would be running into problems into doing her work. Mm-hmm. So,
Good point.
So again, the regression, the consistency, it's a huge problem. It's frightening. It is literally a second round of Jim Crow.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Brian Knowles of Teach, Heal, Build, and historian Dr. Tamika Bradley of the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward County. She's also the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. And we're talking about the observance of Juneteenth, its history and its contemporary importance for communities like ours. Brian Knowles, jumping on then what we've just said, do you worry that, for example, the Trump administration has made no secret of its efforts, at least within the federal bureaucracy, to cancel observances like Juneteenth, Black History Month, Martin Luther King Day, et cetera? They can't actually do that without congressional approval, but still, the fact that they're trying to, you know, nullify the commemoration of those days in federal agencies, is there a chance that Congress could cancel observances like Juneteenth in the future? What does the future of these observances look like to you?
My response is going to be unpopular, but there's no fear here. Mm-hmm. Black History Month, or what was started off at Negro History Week, was celebrated within a Black community for 50 years before mainstream America took a hold of it and made it an official holiday. Mm-hmm. If white America wants to say we're not going to make it an official holiday, that does not stop us from celebrating our history. Mm-hmm. Us as Black folks have survived, and not only survived, thrived in much worse circumstances in this country. And I think we will continue to survive and continue to resist. And despite what federal legislation may say, or even state legislation is saying about our holidays and teaching our stories and our history, the Black community will continue to do that, you know, despite what mainstream America say. We don't have to have a stamp of validation from the prevailing powers or have permission from the prevailing powers to celebrate our history and culture and our experiences. It is up to us within our community to continue to preserve those histories, preserve those celebrations, and continue as status quo when it comes to our story and our history. We don't need anyone outside of our community to stamp that validation. We understand the challenges that we face when it comes to resources and funding to institutionalize what we're doing. But when it comes to preserving our story and celebrating our heroes and our holidays, that is something that still belongs to us within a community.
Tamika Bradley, your thoughts on that? And I'm asking this also not just in the context of the Black community, but you've got the Native American community, for example, that would like to see what has been known as Columbus Day become Indigenous People's Day as a more secure holiday in that sense. I think the Latino community as well has that sentiment. What are your thoughts then on the future of these observances?
Sure. I Brian said it perfectly. I just want to co-sign as the president of the South Florida branch of ASALA, the association that Dr. Carter G. Woodson founded. He's exactly right. We are experts at fugitivity in our culture. We have always done what people didn't believe we could do, didn't want us to do, in order to exercise our full humanity and our self-determination. And while it is incredibly painful to be in this moment, I am fully confident in the ability of our community to not only survive this moment, but to be creative and figure things out. What I really hope is that we find allies who are reliable, who are dependable, who are consistent. Yeah. Because the other lesson of American history is that the times that we have had these significant breakthroughs in our history that have made room for Black folks and everybody mm-hmm. else is that we've had significant allyship from whites. And I think that's something that is sorely missing in this moment.
Can we quickly then go from the macro to the micro, though? How do you feel all this is affecting South Florida institutions? Your library, for example, the Black Chamber of Commerce, et cetera.
I can imagine the impact of this new law, SB 1134, one of the things that I enjoy about living here in South Florida is not only the African diaspora, my brothers and sisters from Haiti, Jamaica, the Bahamas, Guyana, Trinidad and Tobago, and the way that they celebrate their culture, Hispanic culture, Asian Pacific Island culture, to not be able to fund those activities with state or city or county dollars, the landscape is unimaginable. How do you go from this vibrancy? How do you go from having programming that helps us all to connect and to celebrate our culture and our humanity and have this exchange to completely shutting that down? And while, you know, I feel it acutely for my institution, I do not know how we're going to continue to be able to operate as we have these last 24 years. It's not just us, it's the Hispanic community. These few months may be the last time we're able to experience Haitian Heritage Month, Hispanic Heritage Month, Kwanzaa with taxpayer dollars.
You share that concern?
Absolutely.
Brian Knowles?
Mm-hmm. And to add to that, and like Dr. Bradley has expressed continuously, allies, right? That's why it's very critical at this time that we have consistent, reliable, and honest allies, you know, in this fight. Because you have those who have access to resource and also access to power that can still assist and work with the Black community in making things happen.
Mm-hmm. Finally, then, I just wanted to ask you both, why should Juneteenth be considered an American observance as important as the 4th of July? And is that a gauge of how well the American experiment of E Pluribus Unum is or isn't working? Dr. Bradley?
I would agree with that. I see Juneteenth as a necessary corrective to the 4th of July. It helps to complete the story that we can tell about this democracy. Not everybody became an American citizen at the same time. Not everyone had the same opportunities at the same time. And so the more that we can complicate and elevate these stories, the better we all are. And I think Juneteenth is an absolute fantastic holiday. I just imagine what it must have been for my ancestors on May 20th here in Florida, for the Texans on June 19th in their part of the world, to hear the news that after generations of bondage, that the scourge that was enslavement in America was coming to an end. I think that's an incredible moment for our country that we all should celebrate if we believe in freedom. It's an occasion for us all to celebrate.
Brian Knowles?
Share the same sentiment. Enslavement is inextricable to American history, right? And if we want to tell the American story, we have to include what happened, even the inconvenient parts, like I said before. We can't continue to deny those parts which are inconvenient to just the larger narrative of just this land is predicated on freedom and liberty and justice and all of those great things that we haven't fully experienced in this country. And it's an issue of honesty and fidelity. At that point, that we continue to, you know, hold equal value to the 4th of July and also Juneteenth. It is part of American history.
Brian Knowles is CEO and founder of the educational consulting firm Teach, Heal, Build. And Dr. Tamika Bradley is regional manager of Broward County Library's African American Research Library and Cultural Center and the current president of the South Florida branch of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Katie Munoz and Denise Royal with help from Chris D'Avanzo. Denise is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. We leave you with music from Hude Songs. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado. Hello.
WLRN Public Media.